Morning, saints.
Morning.
As you can hear, I've come down with something overnight. So,
back on up.
I better back up from the front line. Yeah, hopefully I can get through this. So, I was actually going to give Ian a call this morning because you're supposed to be ready in and out of season. But I knew Ian would be out, so
well out.
So I thought we'll see whether I can get through it. So, all right, if you've got your Bibles, we're carrying on with Joshua, and we're going to look this morning at chapter 6, which is the conquest of Jericho. So last time that we were in this book, we looked at the significance of Gilgal and how that God wasn't in a hurry to, once he'd brought the nation over the Jordan, he wasn't in a hurry to actually get them into battle. There were certain things that the nation themselves had to get right, you know. They'd forgotten about circumcision. There was no circumcision through the whole of the wilderness wanderings. So we looked at what circumcision was, that it was actually a sign that God loved them and that he had a plan for them. And it was a sign that he would bring them into the land. So now that they're in the land, he has to reinstitute that act of circumcision. So they were all circumcised, and we saw that once that had happened, they started to observe Passover, and the manna ceased, and they started to eat of the good fruit of the land. And so all of these things came about in the place called Gilgal. And Gilgal is, for the Israelite, was the base camp. It was the central point that they were to go out into battle and to come back from. And also, we saw that Joshua came into contact with the man with the sword in his hand. Do you remember? He was going over and he was having a look at this fortress called Jericho. And suddenly he was confronted by a man that had a sword in his hand, and he said to him, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" And the man responded, "Neither." And you had there a picture of one of those times when Christ comes onto the scene as the angel or the commander of the Lord's army. And he had to show Joshua that if he was to go forward into this battle, it wasn't actually about his plans and his methods. It was about receiving instructions. He was under a new headship, the captain of the Lord's host. So when we get to chapter 6, the nation is now ready to enter into battle. And you got these three stages, really, of battle with the Jewish nation. You've got them back in Egypt. They're battling against a slave master and the Egyptian world system. When they're in the desert, what is the battle there? The battle is with the self-life, yeah. The whole 40 years was just defeat after defeat, carnality, mistake, failure, and it was all about this nature that they had within them that just kept bringing them down. They couldn't apply faith to God in their midst. And when you get into the land of Canaan, the battle here is actually in front of them. They've got, they are in the land, and God wants them to inherit and possess all that he has for them. So that the enemy now is in front of them. It's nations by which Israel has to push them out, but it's also spiritual forces and wickedness that they have to push through. It's a little bit like what Ephesians says, you know, that our battle is not against flesh and blood. It's against things that are in a different realm, in a different time, that come against us in our walk. So just as Israel had to go through and they had to fight to obtain all that God had for them, it's exactly the same for you and for I. God has all his wonderful promises for us, but it takes us to press in with God and actually obtain everything that he has for us. So, Jericho. It was a city that was built upon a mound. Apparently archaeologists have found the actual area where Jericho was in Joshua. Apparently there's three Jerichos, all being sort of built and destroyed three times through through the history, but archaeologists have found that the place where they believe is the Jericho of Joshua. Apparently they found a wall. Apparently the city had been rebuilt a few times before Joshua had actually been there. And what they'd done is they had fortified the walls of that city. So you had, the city was built upon a mound, and it was about an area of about 6 acres. Okay? 6 acres, that's about the size of it. We're not sure how many people were in the city. The Bible doesn't tell us. But that's the size of the city, 6 acres. And we know that Rahab dwelt upon the wall. And apparently what they did is they had rebuilt another wall on the outside of the city, about 12 to 15 feet away from the outside of the city wall. It was a wall of protection. And this wall was about 6 feet thick. And some people say it was about 30 feet high. So what you've got is you've got an outer wall of defense, and then you've got the inner wall of the city. So this is what they had. And apparently that to fit everyone in, people dwelt in that gap between the two walls as well. There was houses put in between the two walls. So that sort of accounts with what Rahab had said, that her house was either on the inner wall or up against the outer wall. But they had, apparently there was enough room for everyone to be in the city, and they dwelt in this area, this gap 15 feet wide all around between the two walls. So we get to verse 1, and it says, "Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in." So you've got this picture here of the enemies of God, but yet they're completely shut up. They were afraid of the Israelites. None went out and none came in. You've got this picture of a fortress that's completely closed off. No one's going out, no one's coming in, but they remain there. And they're a hindrance to the nation's walk. For them to go on in, this is their first battle that they have to confront. So what is, when you look at Jericho, what could that be for us? If you take Israel as a type or a picture of our walk, when we're going on with God, we're confronted by something that's a fortress or something that's an obstacle, something that hinders our path. It's absolutely shut up. There's none coming out and there's none going in. They remain secure within this fortress, but it's a battle that has to be confronted. So is there any ideas? Like, when you think about it, for them it was a literal city and a people. For us, what is our Jerichos?
Some of the fortresses that, you know, Satan's come up.
Yep. Corinthians says about pulling down every stronghold and, vain imagination and things that that are locked up within our humanity. So, a Jericho for us is, it could just be a hindrance, something that stops you from actually going on with God. And with each of us, there's something different. You know? There's something that always seems to hinder us fully giving ourselves over to God. It just always remains a fortress in us, whether it's worldliness, whether it's a character trait, whether it's principalities or powers, whether it's just some weakness of our character, but it remains a fortress. It's something that stands opposed to us going on and going in, and it remains securely shut up. So in the same way that Israel had to fight this battle, they had to pass this first fortress that they were confronted with, there's also things in our lives that are just like that. Things that just remain a fortress, they're just shut up to us. We just don't seem to be able to get past them. So how did Israel actually did it? Verse 2, he says, "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor.'" So the first thing you actually need to see is that, whose battle is it? Yeah, it's God's. It's the Lord's battle. And he declares to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and its mighty men of valor. So the first step upon entering upon any type of battle or confronting any type of fortress is that God is the one who is active, and it is God is the one that can actually bring you the victory in that area that is holding you back. bear in mind, when we look at what does Hebrews say about this passage about Jericho, it says, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after encircling 7 days. So this whole thing for the nation of Israel was a walk of faith. Everything is about faith here. It's about God building faith into the nation's heart, but God is the one who is active. How did you start your Christian life? You looked toward the Lord Jesus Christ to do something for you that you actually couldn't do yourselves. But it doesn't mean that that's all you do according to faith. Just as you received him, Colossians says, continue to live in him. In other words, in the same way that you received him, looking to him in all faith, you are to walk in all faith and to go on and to obtain everything that God has for us. So let's have a little look, because everything here is about faith. It's about the nation walking in simplicity of faith and allowing God to actually act on their behalf. Because this is something that they don't have the ability to do. So God gives the directions, right? Verse 3, you shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go around the city once, and this you shall do 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall come to pass when they make the long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout, and then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, every man straight before him. And then Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let the 7 priests bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. And he said to the people, proceed and march around the city, and let him who is armed advance before the Ark of the Lord. And so it was when Joshua had spoken to the people that the 7 priests bearing the 7 trumpets of the ram's horns before the Lord advanced and blew the trumpets, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. And then the armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the ark while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. And now Joshua had commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, shout, and then you shall shout. And verse 11, so he had the ark of the Lord circle the city, going around it once, and then they came into the camp, and they lodged in the camp. So here you've got God giving Joshua from verse 3 to 5 the instructions, and then Joshua tells the priest what to do. You've got ram's horns. Apparently there was 2 types of trumpets that the Israelites had. They had silver trumpets and they had ram's horns. And ram's horns were something that was of God or godly. Apparently it was used at the time of Jubilee. They would use the ram's horn and for war, those 2 events. So, Jubilee was the 50-year becoming free. There'd probably be something and all that. But also for war, ram's horns. You had this picture of the ark being in the centre of everything. They were to go before it and they were to go after it. But in the midst, you had the 7 priests with their trumpets and you had the ark. So, you got the presence of God right in the midst. So, when you start looking at faith, they had to be, the first thing that they had to do concerning faith was actually be obedient to God's directions, to God's instructions. And when you think about it, that must have looked pretty stupid, what they did. I don't know, I'm not a history teacher, but I don't know of any other army in the world that's gone up to a city and then walked around it and then gone back to the camp, you know. And done that for 6 days. If you'd been on the inside of that city, what do you think you would have done? Now you can just imagine the army. Apparently it was a 2-hour trip from where they were, from Gilgal up to Jericho and around and back. They've approximated it as about a 2-hour journey So it's a fair walk. If you had seen them coming, what would you have thought? Well, here they come. And they come right up to the mount, and then they start going around the outside. So you'd marshal your forces around the outside, then they'd go around a little bit further. You go all the way around, and then they'd just start heading back to camp. If you're on the inside, what would you think? You would think, what on earth is going on here? Are they just scoping us out? Are they? So the second day, they come and do the same thing. If you'd been in their military, do you think there would have been a few words spoken at night? You know?
Lots of theories.
Lots of theories? Yeah, that's right. What on earth are they up to? You know?
It could have been mocking. They might have been used to siege ramps and things. And these guys are just walking around the outside. You know, they're not even building anything to breach our barriers.
That's right.
They
probably
don't even seem to have ladders or anything with them.
Yeah. Yeah, there would have been lots of jeering and mocking. So all of those things. So the first thing that they had to do was actually be obedient to God's commands. And it would have looked stupid. And it's interesting when you read through Scripture that God always uses the weak and the insignificant and the things that don't look much in the eyes of the world to actually act strong on behalf of, you know. So the first thing for them confronting this thing, they had to be obedient to God's directions, how stupid it looked. They had to walk up there and walk around and walk back, and the walls were still the same. And they had to do it for 6 days. You know, and on the seventh day, it was seven times around. So they actually walked around 13 times. The second thing that they had to do, which I know Dan was... They actually had to, in verse 10 it says, "Now Joshua commanded the people saying, you shall not shout, nor make any noise with your voice, and nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, shout, then you shall shout." So there had to be obedience, and then there also had to be the discipline of faith. They had to keep their mouth shut. That's really hard. Easier for some, but for others, you think about it, you got a 2-hour journey. You can't say a word. The only noise that was allowed was the priest blowing the trumpets. Why do you think he said no speaking? Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. You know, you go up the end, you go around the first time. If you're allowed to talk, what were some of the things that you'd be saying? What are we doing? This is stupid. Exactly. It's hot. You know? Why don't we just go on and attack? You know? What are we doing this for? But they've got to remain absolutely silent. They're not allowed to say anything, you know? And so that's the discipline that God is actually requiring of the nation to act in faith, that they have got to remain quiet and let God work in the end. And when I was thinking about that, I was thinking, you know, like, God often requires the same thing of us. That we keep our mouth shut. You know? We don't moan about his methods. We don't moan about his ways. See, if they'd been allowed to speak, before long you would have had a committee set up. You know? Someone go and see Joshua. These are 10 men, and we want this thing changed because this just seems ridiculous. Yeah, so when you're looking at faith with the faith with the nation here, it's all about them building and living and walking in faith. So they had to be obedient, they had to be disciplined. And the other one I've got here is they actually had to be patient. Because 13 times is a long time, you know. Because every time they came around, the walls still looked the same. You know, there'd been no change. You know, this actually took time. I think it's something like 600,000 to 800,000 people, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. I think I did read it was about 600,000 prepared for war. Yeah. So it's a lot. And it's a lot of marching. And every time they come around, it still looked the same. And they still got their mouths shut. So, and I don't believe that God declared to Joshua at the beginning what the plan was. And I don't think I don't know if Joshua outlaid it to all the people. Yeah, there's no indication to say he did. He just gives the priest instructions, you know. So, yeah.
Well, that's when Joshua had spoken to the people.
Yep. Well, he did in verse 6 too. He told the priest to take the ark and the trumpets and, yeah. Yeah, he gave them instructions, but it's how much. Yeah. Okay. So we'll carry on reading. And then Joshua rose early in the morning and the priest took up the ark of the Lord. Then the seven priests bearing seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord went on continually and blew the trumpets. And the armed men went before them, but the rear guard came after the ark of the Lord while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. And the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. And they did this for 6 days. But it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early about the dawning of the day and marched around the city 7 times in the same manner. And on that day only they marched around the city 7 times. And the seventh time it happened when the priests blew the trumpets that Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." So the next part of their walk in faith was actually a shout of faith. They'd been obedient, they were disciplined, there was a patience, but you've got this, there was a certain point where they were to actually shout. Has anyone got any ideas about this? Because when I was thinking about it, I actually didn't come up with much, but someone might. Because it's what you got here is an outward confession of belief in God. One scripture I did think of was when the Lord shouts. In 1 Thessalonians it says, at his second coming, there's a shout and the Lord will descend with the trumpet of God. So you've got a shout and you've got a trump and, you know, the dead will rise first and then we who are alive will be caught up. Maybe the same sort of imagery. One wall comes down and I suppose the other... Those go up, and the dead go up. But, yeah, it'll be something. Yeah. I have read what Alistair had said, that some people believe that due to their marching and that the walls crumbled. Whether it was a miracle of God, whether it was just God that actually acted and crumbled the walls, or whether they did have an effect upon the foundations by doing that. It's probably not clear enough.
I see no description of having to stomp as they walk or anything like that. But
yeah. Okay, so in verse 17, "Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messages that we sent." So you've got this wonderful picture of grace in amongst this city. One other thing that you've got here, you've got a typology between what happens here in Jericho and in the book of Revelation. You've got seven priests here, and you've got 7 days, and you've got 7 times around, and you've got silence. In the book of Revelation, you've got... 7 seals, and when the 7th seal is opened, there's silence. There's silence in heaven for about half an hour, it actually says. And when the 7th seal is opened, you've got 7 more bowls, or you've got 7 trumpets, you've got 7 angels. So you've got the same imagery that this is going to be replayed in the last days. Whatever was confronted here in the stronghold is again going to be replayed, whether it's the fall of Babylon as a world system or whether it's a spiritual thing again, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about that shortly. But you've got a midrash. So what happens here happens in in the book of Revelation, with all your numbers of sevens and silence of all things, you know. So yeah. So verse 18, and you by all means abstain from the accursed things, lest you become accursed, and you take of the accursed things, and you make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all of the silver and gold and vessels of bronze and iron are consecrated to the Lord, and they shall come into the treasury of the Lord. So the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpets. And it happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat. And then the people went up into the city, and every man straight before him, and they took the city. So this outer wall just fell down flat, so that the actual armies could just walk on in. And yeah, you've got something that only God can actually do, to crumble that stronghold. Yeah. And then you get to verse 21. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man, woman, young and old, ox, sheep, donkey, with the edge of the sword. And one of the things people say, how can you serve a God of love when he commands the nation to destroy all? And that's one argument that is actually given against, or it's one offence that's taken against the God that we serve. So I wanted to have a little sort of look at that, because God declared to Abraham right back in the beginning. In Genesis chapter 15, Abraham is in the land of Canaan, okay? And in if you start from verse 7, Genesis 15, and then he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to inherit it. And he said, Lord God, how shall I know that I will inherit it? So he said to him, bring me a three-year-old heifer and a three-year-old female goat and a three-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. And then he brought all these to him and cut them in two down the middle. And he placed each piece opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds in two. And when the vultures came down on the carcasses, Abraham drove them away. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, horror and great darkness fell upon him. And then he said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and they will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, you shall be buried at a good old age, but in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Okay, so Abraham's in the land. He's come out of Ur and he's in the land, and he's wanting to know what God's plans for him were. And he said to him, look, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make of you a great nation. This is what's going to happen. The seed from you will actually be afflicted for 400 years. You'll go down into Egypt and you'll serve them. And when you come out, you'll come out with great possessions. But there's a time period here, you know. And he says here in verse 16, but in the fourth generation, after 400 years, they shall return here. This is Canaan that he's talking about. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Okay? So God gave the Amorites and these people groups 400 years to clean up their act, which is a long time. And he's saying that after 400 years, I'm going to actually judge these nations. There is a fullness of sin that at some point I'm going to judge. And it's going to take 400 years with these people. You're going to go away, you're going to be slaves, you'll come out, and you won't come out until their sin is actually at a point where it needs judging. So that is just something, no one gets away with anything. You know, when you read the book of Jude, there's one theme that comes out in the book of Jude, and that is, God judges sin. He doesn't let people get away with stuff, whether it's angels that left their abode, you know. He talks about a judgment for those people, whether it's Sodom and Gomorrah reaching a point of complete wickedness and God actually judges those people, whether it's Cain, whether it's Balaam, whether it's Korah's rebellion in the desert, whether it's the nation of Israel in the wilderness. They paid for sin with their lives. They wandered 40 years and they all died off. But at some point, God judges sin. You don't always get away with it. And so it is with these people here. Okay? The Amorites, the Canaanites, there was a list of seven nations that God said that he was going to push out. But there was a time period that in his wisdom, they were away 400 years and then the iniquity was full. He was going to actually use Israel to be a judgment upon these nations. Now, the other problem that you've got is in Genesis 6, you had problem with angels that left their abode and they're called the Nephilim. And it says in there that they came and tried to wreck the seed of woman, tried to change what a human actually was. You had the strange breed of giants or people with superhuman abilities, men of renown, it says, you know. It happened in the days of Noah, and part of the flood was actually to destroy Satan's attempt to actually corrupt the seed of woman on earth. But it also says back in there that this also happened afterward as well. So there wasn't just one event where these angels left their abode. Okay? When you get to Numbers 13, when the spies went into the land, what was the report that they said? Yeah. We saw the descendants of Anak there, and we were like grasshoppers in their sight, and they were really afraid. So when the nation is about to inherit all that God has for them, you've got this spiritual opposition again to them coming into the land. You've got giants in the land. With David, you had giants in the land, you know? So you've got this opposition, and I wonder whether, you know, like, again, when you start looking midrashically, these things happen time and time. Will the last days be like that? You know, probably so. You know, a lot of Bible teachers believe that what you saw back then and what you saw with the land of Canaan and with David trying to occupy all of that land, it'll be replayed in the end. Is what happens in Revelation partly due to this influx again of the Nephilim within humanity? Look at what's pumped out of Hollywood. When you think of movies, everything is about humans with superhuman abilities. You know, even what stuff that your kids watch. You know, it's all the same sort of line, you know, humans but with superhuman abilities, you know. Whether it be what's the vampire line, you know, the
Vampire Diaries?
Yeah, that or those, what's those other ones?
Twilight.
You know, just all the heroes, Thor, you know, all the Avenger line, all the
X-Men,
mutants. It's all this, yeah, part human, part something else. Yeah. So I do believe that it will be replayed. In the last days, you'll see another attempt, you know. So these giants were a part of these nations. So when you hear people say, how can you serve a God that, if he's a God of love, why does he say to wipe these out? You need to remember that, one, there was a fullness of sin that God was going to judge. And two, you had these evidences of this race of giants in Nephilim amongst these tribes. And God wasn't going to allow that to continue. But it's interesting when you look at what they did, they always sort of, one just seems to survive. When you follow them through, they don't all die. So yeah, so back in Joshua, they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey with the edge of the sword. Verse 22, but Joshua has said to the two men who spied out the country, go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the woman and all that she has, as you swore to her, And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. So they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. So you got this wonderful picture that even though the whole city was doomed to destruction, you got this wonderful picture of God's grace to someone who believed. Someone who believed in the God of Israel and believed he was the true God. And grace is given to her. So you've got this little gem in amongst all this wickedness. And obviously her house wasn't destroyed as where it was on the wall. Verse 24, and then they burned the city and all that was in it with fire. Only the silver, the gold, and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Then verse 26, and then Joshua charged them at that time, saying, cursed be the man before the Lord who rises up and builds the city Jericho. He shall lay its foundation with his firstborn, and with his youngest he shall set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the country. So Joshua put a curse upon anyone who would rebuild that city. 500 years passed from the time that Joshua put that curse upon the city, and no one dared to rebuild it for 500 years until you get to the time of Ahab, who was a wicked, godless king. And he was happy for Hiel to actually rebuild it. And this turned out to be very true. When he was laying the foundations, his firstborn died. And when he set the gates at the end of it, his youngest died as well. So it took 500 years for someone to actually do it, but yeah, they did it and they paid for it. So yeah, so Jericho was destroyed. It was rebuilt by Hiel, and then apparently the Herodians destroyed it in 3 BC, and then a guy called Archelaus rebuilt it, which was around in the time of Christ. And it was destroyed again by some guy called Vespasian in 68 AD, which would have been just before the 470 AD, when the Jews had all their trouble. Yeah. Yeah. So there you have Jericho. Is there any thoughts on that chapter?